You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO, at 102.7 FM.
When the world's nations met in Cancun this past December, few expected that the summit would result in any sort of climate deal. Indeed, it was somewhat of a surprise that when the summit closed, it was announced that consensus had been reached. But was it really consensus? And was it really a deal? Ben Paulus went to Cancun. He was part of the official talks as a member of the Indigenous Peoples Caucus. He was also on the outside in his capacity with the Indigenous Environmental Network. And he joins us by phone now from Ottawa. Hello, Ben, and thanks for joining us today.
Hi, thanks for having me.
As I mentioned, you were part of the official talks. What was your role at the climate talks?
Well, working on the inside negotiations basically involves, as part of the caucus, working with Indigenous peoples who have come there for the negotiations from really around the world. And what we were trying to do was basically make sure that there were some protections for Indigenous peoples and Indigenous peoples' rights contained within the negotiations. And so the work was a mixture of everything from lobbying to doing media reports, to actually meeting with, you know, other organizations and other allies, groups who would be able to also help and support the cause. And that was the primary job on the inside. On the outside, there was a lot of other sort of civil society forums and public gatherings that were going on that, you know, in a similar way, we were very much there to attend, to sort of share our own participation and also, you know, talk about Canada and talk about, you know, some of the issues, particularly with the tar sands that we have going on here, and share those with other organizations and civil society groups that come really from around the world as well.
Let's first have a look at your role on the inside. You were involved as part of the Indigenous Caucus. What kind of concerns were Indigenous groups pushing during the negotiations?
Well, I think the primary concern for Indigenous groups, the really most outstanding one, has been, you know, the fact that countries are not doing anything to resolve the issues of climate change, which really threatens the long-term survivability and, you know, general ability for a lot of Indigenous groups to really continue to practice their cultures around the world. And so that's been, you know, the number one sort of concern for Indigenous peoples. But the second big threat, I would say, is the very responses that, you know, countries are taking to you know, in their terms, battle climate change. Many of these actually threaten Indigenous communities around the world, because, you know, they basically follow along the same lines of you know, this type of production and development model that we've seen in the past that has been so detrimental. And so we've seen the inclusion in things like biofuels, like clean development mechanisms that are, you know, basically pay for mega dam projects, and other similar projects, including, you know, plans for this reducing emissions from deforestation and degradation project, being contemplated in a similar manner that would, you know, in many ways threaten Indigenous communities and Indigenous rights around the world. And so, you know, one of the main concerns was to make sure that, you know, at the outset, some of these plans wouldn't be included, and where they would be included, to make sure that we have the strongest safeguards and human rights protections possible.
Now, there was a little expectation of any sort of agreement going into the negotiations. How is it that the summit finished with a set of accords being announced?
Well, it's kind of a funny thing, I guess. Like you said, there was little expectation, I think, from the outset, and I think countries had been trying to sort of downplay this summit because of the incredibly high expectations attached to the Copenhagen summit of last year. And so, basically, I think countries were looking for, you know, even the slightest sort of set of papers to go home with and declare, you know, some sort of major victory with. After, you know, basically they had to go home last year and say, look, we didn't really come up with anything, despite, you know, what Obama may have, you know, announced and Stephen Harper may have signed on to. The Copenhagen Accord wasn't in any way a binding agreement. This year produced what at the end was called the Cancun Accord or Cancun Deal. And basically what happened was you have these sets of negotiations that have been going on over the past few years and that have gradually been seeking consensus on a number of areas. And over the course of the two-week conference this year, the chairs of some of the working groups began to sort of not abandon those negotiations over the past number of years, but to sort of suggest their own interpretations of how the texts would basically be finalized, and basically started to present these piece by piece to countries and get those, get the official talks that have been going on to basically slowly be replaced by this, you know, sort of secondary level approach. And in the end, what happened was that, you know, these negotiations were pretty much accepted by most countries around the world. The only one who actively stood in opposition was Bolivia. There were a number of other countries that had objections and concerns, but they, you know, at the last minute acquiesced to the, you know, overwhelming number of countries who said, you know, we want to see this accord adopted and, you know, have something come out of Cancun. But what was actually contained in the accord, I would say is almost like a step backwards in a lot of ways, in that it allows for some of the provisions of the Copenhagen Accord, which are some of the weakest that we've ever seen in terms of any international discussions of climate change, have the potential to be sort of finalized and, you know, stay in a long-term sort of way as the proposed solutions to climate change. And these include some really, really, I think really dangerous measures, including the allowal for countries to basically give their own pledges on what they'll do about climate change, not tied to a legally binding regime, as was the Kyoto Protocol. You know, even though Canada didn't actually comply with anything, it was still a legally binding commitment. Now what we have is the ability of countries like Canada say, well, we're only going to do maybe 10% based on 2005 levels and get away from, you know, all sense of historical responsibility and responsibility to, I think, countries of the global south. The other major piece was in terms of funding. And here, it was a very similar sort of idea that, you know, countries in the north were going to abandon their obligations and say they're going to look to mobilize. That was the word they used, look to mobilize money from countries to go to the global south. And this includes a number of private funders, but also international groups like the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund, who we all know, of course, have very, very sort of mixed dealings and really negative histories in a lot of countries, especially throughout the Latin America and Africa and Asia. And so it was, you know, it was primarily through the use of these things, as well as, you know, a number of other details within negotiations that, you know, countries, I think, almost took a step backwards this year in sort of signing on is what many have said could be the end of the Kyoto process by getting away from this legally binding commitment.
As a result of these accords, what kind of environmental and social costs will there be if the accords are implemented as they stand right now?
Well, what happened in Copenhagen Accord, with the Copenhagen Accord last year, which this basically replicates the results of, the United Nations, interestingly, produced their own sort of analysis of it. It wasn't meant for general release, but it got leaked, I think, to The Guardian in the UK. And what it basically showed was that based on, you know, their own estimates, based on countries' own, you know, insufficient pledges, it basically guaranteed that global warming would be on a level of at least 2 to 3 degrees Celsius. And at 2 to 3 degrees Celsius, we also are threatened with some of the effects of runaway climate change from things like gases escaping from the Arctic, and, you know, just the fact that the oceans will start to warm up at an uncontrollable rate that, you know, really threatens 4 to 6 degrees average global warming, which in countries like Canada can translate to as much as even more than 12 or 14 degrees in some places like the north. And so at these kind of levels, you know, what we're talking about is not just, you know, simple changes in weather patterns and in seasons and, you know, talking about slightly warmer summers. What some scientists are saying is that, you know, this potentially threatens the survivability rates of between, you know, 30, 50, maybe even higher percentages of all the species on the planet. And, you know, we're talking about basically, you know, exterminating half of all the life on planet. And at that rate, you know, it almost becomes difficult to imagine, you know, how humanity will be able to proceed, how we'll be able to survive with huge agricultural shortages in parts of the world, with huge inaccessibility of water and waters and lakes and glaciers drying up across, you know, vast regions of the world. And I think, you know, it really threatens, I think, the long-term survivability of humanity at the outset. You know, when you really, really, you know, boil it down and try and get to what, you know, this all means in the future. You know, especially for a lot of indigenous peoples, I think it means, you know, levels of genocide across the world, basically, you know, exterminating of entire cultures. They've already said, you know, the Arctic could basically completely become, basically completely melt. But also places like the Amazon, they're saying, could become 50% savanna, basically wiping out, you know, some of the biggest ecosystems that we have on our planet, and also threatening all of the peoples that live inside of these ecosystems as well.
Well, a year ago in Copenhagen, for many of the reasons that you mentioned about glaciers melting and so on, many countries objected to the accords. Why did they sign on to a similar document this time?
My sense is that countries, you know, as a result of last year, there's a huge widespread sense of that, you know, we're never going to get to a global deal if things continue on this way, that there's no hope left for international processes, that, you know, maybe there's no hope left at all. And that this year, coming to the negotiations, countries just wanted something that they could go home with, something that they could say, you know, we have an agreement, no matter how minimal it was, and, you know, we have something that we're going to continue along with. And, you know, really, really based on, you know, being there in the last moments of the negotiation, as countries were basically discussing this, you could sort of hear that in some of the rhetoric they were using in terms of talking about how vastly different this was than Copenhagen, even though it was very similar circumstances, how countries, you know, were basically, you know, getting back into the spirit of making these international agreements. Meanwhile, countries last year had basically got up, you know, when presented with some of the same material, presented with some of the same scenarios, and, you know, many countries around the world had vehemently objected and said that, you know, the 2 degrees warming that was laid out in some of the documents as, you know, a maximum, but potentially also a minimum, based on the scientific analysis, would be unacceptable to them and would represent, you know, genocidal acts in many of their countries. Many of the same countries this year, you know, basically got up and applauded when this thing was passed. Of course, except for the case of Bolivia and a number of other objectors. So it really begs the question, you know, what are they really there for? Are they really there for the media opportunities and to, you know, try and go back and sell something to the public back home? Or are they really there to try and negotiate some sort of global deal that has the potential to you know, have some sort of potential to save humanity and save some of the species on the planet?
Well, this accord, as you describe it, sounds like a failure to confront climate change. What kind of things are you calling on people to do to genuinely fight climate change?
Well, I think that, you know, being here in Canada and recognizing that Canada has been actually recognized as the worst country, the worst negotiator at the climate change negotiations, we have a huge responsibility here in Canada to challenge and change our own government. You know, in the recent days, Peter Kent has come out and said, the new environment minister, that, you know, he recognizes the tar sand as being ethical oil, basically following upon Ezra Levant's, you know, sort of political positions there. And, you know, we have to recognize that, you know, there's no such thing as ethical oil in the first place. And the fact that, you know, the tar sands in Canada is, you know, basically our biggest scoring points of source of emission, and really stands as a blight upon us and the rest of the world. And, you know, it's one of those reasons why Canada is no longer recognized and respected on an international scale, is because of projects like this. So I think in Canada we have a huge opportunity, but also a huge responsibility to stand up and, you know, not just confront and challenge the government and the politicians, but also some of the worst projects that are going down and being undertaken in the name of Canadians, such as the tar sands.
Well, thanks so much, Ben, for joining us today, and thanks also for your good work down in Cancun.
Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate that.
I've been speaking with Indigenous and climate campaigner and reporter Ben Paulus. He attended the summit as part of the Indigenous People's Caucus and as a representative of the Indigenous Environmental Network.